Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 8 of Agriculture. I'm Jessica Benson with the American Ag Network here out of Fargo, North Dakota, and I'm talking to Luke Schubert today, auctioneer and cattle producer himself. Luke and I were just talking, and we decided the last time that we saw and or spoke to each other was in July of 2009, at the National High School Rodeo Finals in Farmington, New Mexico, when I gave him and Meg McPadden a permission to steal the rest of my parents' beer. Because I think that year at Nationals, us Minnesota kids, we all finished pretty well. Maybe I think all of us were in the top 10 or at least top 20 of anything we went down there for. So it was a celebration. But yeah, how have you been since then, Luke?
I've been good. I've been keeping busy, that's for sure. I see you've been killing it, following you on social media a little bit. I like to see how outspoken you are for agriculture. And I think we need a voice. A good young voice like you goes a long way sometimes.
Well, thank you. Yeah, and you yourself. I mean, we've had social media conversations, I guess you could say. But I mean, yeah, the more the merrier. The more of us there are, the better. It seems like we're kind of a dying breed, and that's really unfortunate, especially in the atmosphere that we're trying to work in as far as agriculture goes. We are always demonized in mainstream media, in Washington, and it's a tough battle. I'm glad that I'm on this side. I'm glad that I grew up in agriculture, and I'm glad that I got to experience it firsthand, because if you don't, then why would you understand it? So that's where it leaves us here today. That's why we're doing this, is to put ourselves out there and bridge that communication gap between producer and consumer. So where do you want to start with this? Let's talk about life as an auctioneer, first of all.
Okay. Well, I've been an auctioneer for just a few years now. It's only been about 3 or 4 years. I think I went February 2017 to auction school. So it's
what inspired you to become an auctioneer?
A big part of it was my grandpa's an auctioneer. He's 80 years old now, and he's been an auctioneer since he was 18. So I guess I grew up going to some of his auctions, and then growing up on a cattle ranch, kind of the highlight of the year is going to the sale. You know, the one time a year where you sell the calves. I've always really liked that. It's always kind of fascinated me. I've kind of got a economics based mind. That's what I've always excelled at in school and everything. So when I go to an auction and they're selling millions of dollars worth of cattle in a short amount of minutes, and just the action and the speed and how much is going on, if you know what you're looking at, it fits a person like me really well. It just sucked me right in. I've kind of always wanted to do it. I thought it's something that would fit my skill set and personality. I thought it would fit pretty well. So
you're really into the economics side of things. I think if I could go back to school, I'd either go back, I always say, for meat science or economics, because I also think economics is pretty fascinating. And there's a whole lot of us Americans that don't know anything about it. It's which is unfortunate and causes a lot of problems and misunderstandings. Yeah, economics is an interesting subject. It's really important.
Yeah, it's always clicked for me for some reason. I never dreamed I'd went to college until I hit economics in high school. Then I finally found something that just made sense to me. That's what my brain kind of followed. That's where I wanted to go. Had a great economics teacher in high school, which I was lucky enough to have. And it just kind of one thing led to another. So that's what I went to college for, agricultural business with a marketing minor, I guess it would have been. And yeah, the economics classes is always where I guess I excelled and where I enjoyed my time. So,
right.
And I see, as an auctioneer, that's all I deal with. So,
right. Yeah. And I always say, like, if people just understood basic supply and demand, we'd be a lot further ahead in life.
Definitely. Yeah. A lot of people struggle with it. That's for sure.
Yeah. It's such a basic concept, but it's everything. It dictates everything in life. But so let's talk about benefits of auctions from your perspective, because this podcast is all about, I want to get people from all sectors of agriculture, and I want them to come on here and talk about the issues within their little realm of what they do. So tell me, what are the benefits of having auctions?
The benefits of auctions are true price discovery is probably the biggest thing. To find out what something's actually worth that day and in that environment. Everybody's got their own opinion on what something's worth. But when you let everybody bid competitively and find out who's the top bidder, I think that's the best way to find out true market value. Past that, it gives an opportunity to sell anything. You know, you really can, any quality, any amount, anything you can sell, because you just got to get the bidders there. I guess as an auctioneer and an auction company, that's the job, is to get the right bidders, the right buyers lined up, and then let them compete for something. And as long as the right people are there, I think you'll always come up with the true value of something.
Sure. And so you've got, you know, like auctions, like the Sale Barn. The Sale Barn, where yeah. I grew up, has a sale every Thursday. But then you've got private auctions. I just went to a bull sale at Wild Angus Farms in Shevlin, Minnesota. Would you say that there are pros or cons to, like, you know, the Sale Barn or versus having your own private auction?
For a bull sale, I think you definitely want to have your own auction, whether it's at a Sale Barn or at your place, probably doesn't matter much. Just advertise it well. Make sure that all the producers in the area know of your bulls, know what your program's all about, know what you're trying to accomplish as a seed stock producer, and then get have a sale where everybody would come for that. If you just bring them in on a normal Thursday to where you're talking about, or you got a bunch of breeding bulls and didn't tell anybody about them, probably ain't going to go as good as if you, the advertising, kind of the hype behind it is what's going to sell them the best. I don't think it matters too much where it's at, if it's at the farm or at the Sale Barn, as long as it's advertised and brought up the right way, I think it'd do just fine.
Right. And I'm just asking questions from the perspective of someone that does not know anything about auctions or how they're set up or the inner workings of it all. I think my mom, she ran the scale at the Sale Barn for years and years. But all I knew was that I could go to the Sale Barn and have lunch and just charge it to my mom. That's about as far as my knowledge went of the Sale
Barn. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. That and running up and down the catwalk. That was probably frowned upon by the people working, but that's what I did as a kid. You know, you just cause problems. So let's talk about something that has been controversial for a long time in the cattle industry, and that is COOL or M-COOL. So for those that maybe aren't familiar with COOL, it is country of origin labeling for beef products, and then M-COOL is mandatory, the mandatory version of that. So what are your thoughts on this topic? Do you think it is beneficial? Do you think it's not beneficial? Do you think parts of it are? I mean, what's your opinion as an auctioneer as well as an American cattle producer?
Well, I guess my opinion, more as a producer probably than an auctioneer, is that I think we all wish we knew where our meat comes from. You know, so if we can get a country of origin labeling on it, that's great. I'd love to know that everything that I eat when I go somewhere is raised in the U.S. I understand there's a lot of difficulty with that, though, on the packing end. When you start bringing in Canadian cattle, Mexican cattle, stuff like that, I don't like that they'd have to shut the plants down and make things really inefficient. I guess that's probably my biggest problem with mandatory country of origin labeling. I think there's got to be a way we could do a kind of a compromise and do North American origin, you know, because anything killed in the U.S. is from North American origin, or 99% of it, I would think. So that'd be good enough for me. You know, I've got no problem eating Canadian cattle or whatever. And then as far as the rest of it, I think the producers would benefit. Just the more meat that they bring in from other countries and mix in with ours, I think can hurt us a little bit. I understand we got to trade both ways with countries. You know, that's a thing that a lot of producers don't understand, is you do got to trade both ways. But I think the consumer deserves the right to know at least generally where it came from. The more information for the consumer, the better, especially today. All the consumers are really looking right now, trying to find out as much as they can about everything. They're really concerned with where things come from, how it was raised. The more information we can give them, the better. So I'm not completely for or completely against it. I just wish that we'd have some type of saying, some way of saying you know, that it's at least slaughtered in the U.S. or from North American origin, something like that.
Correct. And, you know, I agree. When I first heard about us importing cattle and or beef, I was like, well, what the heck for? You know, and then I did some research, and then things, you put pieces together, and well, you know, kind of makes sense. Just like you said, trade goes both ways. And then also when we do import, let's say, live cattle, yes, they're at the packing facility, it becomes a bit of a hassle because those cattle need to be sorted off. And then when they're slaughtered, you still have to keep track of them as they go down the line. So that adds costs. And I think sometimes people don't always think about that. But it's definitely part of the issue. And I think, go ahead.
It's not always easy to tell, you know, if it's all straight imported animals, it'd be easy to schedule them in. You know, you got loads coming from Canada, that's fine. But us growing up rodeo, and we know that there's a lot of M-branded rope and steer, stuff like that. So you have one of them come through the slaughter line. It's got the M brand on the side. Well, that's from Mexico originally. So then they got to shut everything down or get that one out of the system. Like I said, if you could just schedule loads, I think they could do it fine. But we've got so many cattle from Canada and Mexico mixed in to ours because, they're our neighbors, that it would be – I can see from the Packers' perspective how it can be extremely difficult to keep them out of there.
Yes.
And a lot of producers don't understand that. But.
Yeah. I've found, myself included, a lot of producers just don't know a whole lot about the packing side or the meat industry. But another thing to keep in mind as well is the cattle industry is not like the poultry or pork industry, where there's hardly any variation in the animals that they produce. Cattle, we have a lot of variation, a lot of breeds. Like you said, there might be some Corian roping steer in there that someone just decided to fatten up. And, you know, so that adds some more complications to the whole process. It would be a little different if we were uniform. But then people run into the worry of, well, could the cattle industry be vertically integrated like pork has become or poultry? A lot of people will argue that they would have a hard time seeing that happen just because cattle take longer to finish. But I mean, what do you think about that? I think you and I have talked about that before. Do you think the cattle industry could be vertically integrated?
I think there's potential for it, for sure. I mean, there's no limit to what large companies and corporations can do. It takes a lot of land for cattle because you need grass. Without grass, the costs go extremely higher. We know that. But they could buy the land. There's ways that it could happen. I hope it never does. I enjoy the Western way of life. I enjoy everything that being a cattle producer offers us, the freedom, the flexibility to kind of raise the cattle you want, how you want to do it. So I'm hoping that we can stay as independent cattle producers as long as possible. There'd be a lot of challenges to make it vertically integrated. But as monopolistic as the big four packers are, I can't say it would never happen, you know. I hope it never does. People didn't see it happening in the hogs either until all of a sudden it was kind of there. A few big companies own that all the way from the bottom up. So,
yes. And another thing too is foreign ownership of farmland. That's getting concerning.
Yes.
But yeah, the meat side of things, very complicated. I always refer people back to these webinars that NDSU put on this last summer. If you want to understand the meat sector, go watch those. They're extremely educational. They clear up a lot of the gray area of the packing industry. Again, back to the big four, I'm always playing devil's advocate. So why have things become so concentrated like that? Well, it's because it's efficient, it's economy of scales. This is how things have evolved to feed this growing world. I mean, 2050 is the big year for us in agriculture, where food production is gonna have to be significantly higher than it is right now. And it's always it's things like this happen because it's our, we are answering the call to feed and take care of the consumer. So that's another unfortunate reality.
Right. It is definitely the most efficient. The big four, I mean, the packing plants we have now is as efficient as you could get. It makes food as cheap as possible. I mean, the food supply we have in America is the best, the cheapest that the world's ever seen. So there's definitely positives to it. I think the negatives come, we've seen it with coronavirus, that all of a sudden one of those big packing plants goes down. Well, the rest of the plants can't really choke all the cattle. So that's where efficiency, I'm an efficiency guy. I love efficiency. I mean, economics and efficiency go together, but efficiency is not always everything. So that's where I think the more we can have smaller packing plants, the more mom and pop shops that are up, the more little meat plants like that, I think can go a long ways. I grew up, I've always butchered, cut and wrapped everything our own meat. My grandpa's got a little shed where we've got all the meat cutting tools. So I understand it completely what it takes to cut something up. And I understand it's a lot of work and it's some work that a lot of people don't want to do. So it makes sense to give it to the big four packers and just let that happen in the big plants. But coronavirus definitely showed me the downside to efficiency. One plant goes down, two plants go down. And then what do we do with all these cattle that are ready to be slaughtered? And luckily cattle, you can keep around a while. The hogs was a whole different story. They can't stick around. So, I mean, they've seen it just as bad as we did for sure.
Yes. And I forgot about the hogs that had to be euthanized and, you know, poultry. It's luckily it never had to happen for cattle as far as I know. But
we've seen when that happened, even at the sale barns, there was all of a sudden hundreds and hundreds of hogs at the sale barns every week. Every sale barn had hundreds of hogs. Up here anyways. And it was just crazy because they had nowhere else to go with them. So they were hoping that all the local farmers, the guys that have a meat sale would buy them and, you know, they'd get something for them. It wasn't a lot at times. I remember selling hogs for 10, 11 cents a pound, but yeah. Those guys were just happy to get rid of them. So.
Yeah. And I bought a pig from a friend and I was like, well, let's buy a few. Let's just slaughter them ourselves. Like, I took one semester of meat processing. I can do this, you know, but right. No. And that brings me back to, again, another point why these packing plants have become so concentrated is because nobody wants to work at a packing plant.
Nobody does.
It's another downside. And a friend of mine just told me that somewhere in Nebraska, they're trying to open a packing plant. It might be in North Platte.
Okay, but, I think I heard about that.
Yeah, a lot of what I've heard is a lot of the locals are against it because of they're going to have to bring in foreign workers. So people don't like that. But then again, you know, people want smaller. It's you can't win. It feels like.
Right. I know exactly what you mean, and it's not the funnest work out there. I mean, some people really enjoy butchering and all of that, and I don't mind it. Like I said, I've done it my whole life. So that's one perspective I think I have that a lot of cattle producers don't have, is I've seen every aspect of the cattle industry from pulling calves to when it comes time to butcher one. And it makes me sympathetic to the packers. I'll say that because it's work people don't want to do and it'd be hard to make it smaller. I do think there's a few things we could do better. Especially as far as the small butcher shops we have, like in Piers, where I work at Rich Prairie Livestock, they have a local Thielen Meats. It's kind of nationally known. They've got a lot of, it's a really good little meat store, but they've got to buy all box beef to sell to the public. They can't butcher anything there and sell it because they're not USDA inspected. They're state inspected, but not USDA. I think that's something that could easily change because as an auctioneer, I'd love to see them send a guy every Monday to buy a couple cows and a couple fat steers that they then sell to all the local people. I think that that would be better for the producers. It'd put another buyer in the stands and it would, and then everybody that stops in Piers and thinks that they're getting local meat, they actually are getting local meat. You know, right. I think that's one thing we could change that would help. It would help a lot of things in my opinion.
Right. And the pandemic has, I think, woke up consumers a bit to food production and where they're food comes from, more so than ever. So there's always a silver lining to everything. And I think consumers are maybe demanding a bit more local. You know, I don't like to always say, you know, going to the grocery store and you buying your produce and meat there, that's still supporting local farmers and ranchers. I'm not a huge fan of the whole support local concept. I understand what its intentions are, but even if you go to the grocery store, whatever grocery store, Hornbacher's, Safeway, it doesn't matter, buying your meat or your produce there is still supporting farmers, obviously, over 90% of farms and ranchers are family owned, even if they are astronomically big or, you know, just your tiny little hobby farm. It's all family owned. One thing I didn't want to make, this is kind of veering off, but you were talking about being a cattle producer, being a cowboy. Like it is a business first and foremost, but it is definitely a lifestyle that you and I grew up around. And I think a lot of people, and I probably from other countries, but they say Americans have no culture, but I always like to say no. The American cowboy is American culture. That's more American than you can. Nothing is more American than the American cowboy. And you've got people from other countries. They want to be a cowboy. I'm just saying. So right.
And then now, I mean, you got shows like Yellowstone and stuff. There's been a lot of people also want to be a cowboy. It's crazy to me, but it's fun. Yeah, it is the best culture that I guess growing up with it, the culture has been amazing. You know, I grew up in Brainerd, which is a town that doesn't have much agriculture. I kind of live on the just outskirts far enough of like the school district to where we do have cattle and stuff. Brainerd's more known for lakes and all of that. Yeah. So where I went to school, I didn't have any friends that were farmers, or very few. And, you know, I see both sides. I've been on both sides and I love the cowboy culture. I love the Western culture, especially all of agriculture though. I mean, there's a lot of dairy producers around here too. And that's a little different culture, but it still is wholesome for sure. And
we'll still include them.
Yeah. Right. Right. Right.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit we have been talking about it, but cattle transparency or price transparency in the market and maybe the legislation surrounding that. Do you keep current on what's happening there?
I try to. I try to keep up with it. It's hard to find good information on it sometimes to know exactly the pros and the cons of it. I try to as best as I can, but it's not always easy to do. I do know that they're still trying to get through the 50-14 deal, which would be good. The Cattle Market Transparency Act, I think we need something to make more negotiated cash trade in the cattle markets. What big problem we have is the formula. I mean, most cattle are sold on formula basis to the packers. The big feedlots have formula deals with the packers, and that works out fine. And then the smaller guys do grid marketing, and that works good too. But then the packers hold all the cards because you send them in early or the contract in early anyways. So they all know where they got them. They can schedule them weeks in advance, if not months. And they base it all off of the negotiated cash price. And when the negotiated cash price ends up being the worst cattle in the country, and then you try to, everybody talks about the benefits they get of going on the grid, the premiums that they get. That's great, but you don't want to base it off the worst. In my opinion, I'd rather base it off the best cattle. And then if yours aren't as good, then deduct it from there. Yeah,
so the negotiated... Why isn't it just like that already? Again, I grew up, I'm a rancher's daughter, but I'm not privy to all of these things, the ins and outs. And I mean, from your perspective as an auctioneer, you definitely know more than me. So why isn't it just like that? Why don't they just make it like that? Why don't they base it off the best cattle?
Because people like a premium. So when they say, if you can go 2/3 your cattle can go prime, you'll get this much of a premium. Well, that's great. So then they send them in there and then they get that premium and then it's contracted. So they know a price. The one thing that scares people about bringing them to a sale barn or having a negotiated price of any type is some days the markets aren't the best. You know, it could be the day after they shut everything down on Corona and the market tanks and the buyers aren't there. It don't happen very often, but it does happen a couple times throughout history. People are scared of that type of stuff, so they like a contract. Contracts aren't all they're cracked up to be, though, either. There's a lot of contracts that did not get honored when Corona happened. People had cattle contracted for long ways that they kept telling them, well, next week, and then pretty soon, well, we can't take them at all. And so the producers tied into the contract definitely, and the packing plan is not. And that can be definitely a tough situation. I guess I like competition. That's what I like about the auction market is there's competition there. I think the packing plant should have buyers there, and it should be off of, you know, if a guy, I see it every week. We sell a lot of fat cattle, and the people that consistently bring us good cattle that the buyers know are going to grade well, are going to do well, they'll always bring a premium at the market. They'll always bring a premium. I think that's the way it should be. It should go off of your history as much as anything. I don't think it would be a bad idea to, you know, I've never seen cutout reports or anything like that as an auctioneer to say that this guy's steers always go this percent prime, this percent choice. I don't think that'd be a bad idea. If guys had a little more information that I could give the buyers, the more information, the better, in my opinion. It's not saying these cattle will do that, but if he historically over a 10-year period has always hit certain numbers, I think that it'd be a good selling point.
It's almost like an EPD for fat cattle, right?
Almost, but, yeah, exactly. But on the producer's side.
Yeah.
Right? And that's the hard part. And the cattle industry is so much is based on your reputation as a producer, especially when you come to the auction market. You know, if you're known for having good cattle and doing a good job, ones that people can trust, and you're not putting things together for say, or not trying to slide something by, you know, crossbred or something like that in there. If you're known for doing that stuff, people don't want to buy your cattle. If you're known for having good, honest cattle, they'll bid extra on them every time. That's one thing that I guess you don't have to worry about in the hog and chicken industry is you don't have to have a reputation. The cattle producers need to have a good reputation to stay in business. And I think that keeps them honest. And I think that keeps them doing a good job. So
yeah, that's a good point. And so the 5014 bill, that I think it's Chuck Grassley.
As far as I know, yep.
Yeah, he's been pushing this for quite a while. So what would be pros or cons of that bill going or getting passed? Or is it passed?
I don't think it's passed. I'm not sure. But definitely the pro would be it would force the packers to buy 50% negotiated cash. So then 50% of the cattle to each facility would have to be negotiated could be that they're put out for bids. There's a lot of different ways of doing it, but through the auction markets is one way of doing it as well. And I guess I prefer it that way. And then there's more competition right now. I think it's less than 10% is negotiated cash. And then they base all the prices off of the negotiated cash price. Well, how do you base the whole country's prices off of less than 10% of the cattle?
Right. And are those cattle,
especially in the South, in the North here, I guess we're quite a bit better in 10%, but in the South is where it's the worst for.
Yeah. And so if it's only 10% of cattle, then where are those cattle at? Are they coming out of Florida? Are they coming out of, cause you got different breeds, and how are you basing a price when you have such a variation with cattle?
Right. Right. And it doesn't hardly matter what they are. But that is the negotiated cash price, usually on the poorer end cattle. And then people contract and grid contract and do all that on the better cattle. And they feel like they're doing better than their neighbor because they get a $3 a pound premium, but you're just a premium over poor cattle, in my opinion. I think it's better to just have competition on them. I like buyers sitting there and I like them to be aggressive on cattle. If they needed to have 50% or 30% negotiated cash that they had to buy at the sale barns, they had to hit that number, those buyers would get aggressive on some cattle. And that's going to help everybody. You know, the biggest thing a buyer likes to do at a sale barn is tell you they don't need cattle. They like to sit there like they don't need nothing and act like, because their job is to buy it as cheap as they can. So they like to act like they don't need cattle. If you can make them need cattle, they need to buy a certain percentage. The plant needs that. It's going to raise prices. I don't see how it wouldn't, I guess, in my opinion.
So I've heard people say, okay, you don't like the price you're getting, just hold them. So why is it not just that simple? If you took your cattle to the sale barn and you don't like the price that day, why doesn't everyone just get together and hold your cattle? Don't sell them. You know, I've heard this, so I have to ask because it's been put out there.
Oh man, that's a tough one. You know, if you can hold them a week or something, that's all right. You know, like I've held cattle before, it gets muddy at home or something, I can't ship them. I hold them for a week, or if the market kind of went down one week, I think it'll be better the next, I'll hold them. But to try to get everybody to do that, everybody's operations are so different. I mean, you got to move cattle in, you got to move cattle out. You just, everybody's got something different going on. You can, it'd be so hard to get a unison effort to hold cattle back and try to get a better price. And somebody's always gonna jump in there, you know, sell them as soon as they go up a dollar. You say, we're gonna wait for $3 more, so we're gonna hold back. Well, as soon as they go up a dollar, somebody's gonna probably give in, and you know, because then they think they'll have the packers' favor. That is what it is, but it just, there's so many producers that it would be almost impossible to try to hold back like that. And when cattle are ready, they're ready. I mean, you only have a week or two there that you really are gonna wanna get rid of them, and that's the way it is. So.
Right. So my dad likes to wait until the coldest day of the year. Is there a correlation with that and prices? Because it seems like it. I was, you know, but that's a conversation for another day.
Sure.
Well, it's 40 below.
Well, we sell in January in Minnesota too. That's when I've always sold my calf. So I think we're under the same philosophy for some reason. I don't know why.
Okay. But. All right, so the coldest day of the year in Minnesota is when you should sell your calves, because apparently that's when the prices are good. For anyone out there listening that was maybe curious about that.
That is usually, this year especially, that was the time to sell kill cows, butcher cows.
Yeah.
We had 2 weeks where it was like 30 below. I don't know if you remember that, not that long ago. And the packing plants could not find enough cows to kill to keep running. So they were paying crazy prices.
Really? So
that's all of a sudden they need them. That's what I mean. When they need cattle, they need them. They need to keep the lines running. They need to keep things going. And then they get aggressive on them. And the buyers are told, you know, they're not given a certain price to say, we need them, get three loads. And you can tell when they're told that, because they just keep bidding. And we had butcher cows into the mid 80 cent range there for a while, which was 20 cents over the week before and about 20 cents over the week after, or 2 weeks after, because we had 2 weeks of really high prices just because it was too cold. Guys didn't want to get cattle in. It was hard to haul them. It was hard to do anything when it's 40 below. That's just the way it is. But
well, somehow my dad finds a way.
But, yeah, he's tough though. I know that. So he'll find a way.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. But, shoot. Yeah. So let's talk about the public's environmental and social perception of beef production. We know it's not good. It's not a good perception in general.
Right. I don't know if it is or not. Most people I run into anywhere, it isn't as bad as I think it is. There's definitely a portion of the population that thinks it's absolutely terrible. They think it's ruining the world. They somehow try to blame global warming on cattle production. To me, it is... it doesn't make any sense to me how you'd blame cattle, I guess. When I look at cattle on grassland, you know, the same grass is made to be eaten. That's what it is. The buffalo ate it. If the cattle weren't there, there'd be more deer. There'd be more something eating that grass. The grass is made to be eaten. There'd always be something eating. Maybe that it's not a ruminant. Maybe they produce a little less gas, but they're still going to produce something. And even if the grass goes unused and then falls over and gets broken down by worms and whatever else, are still gas released. So I guess I have a hard time blaming cattle. It's illogical to me to try to blame cattle, but a lot of people do blame it. I hope we can somehow make them see it. I think if they would get out of the city a little more, I think that's where the biggest problem is. I'm not in the city very often, but they could get out of there, see the countryside, see the way the world's naturally supposed to be with grass, things like that, and not all concrete. I mean, it's hard for, I think a big problem cattle producers have is it's hard to have somebody that lives in a concrete jungle tell you that you're ruining the world when you're living as natural as you can. You know, you're trying to, especially as a cattleman, I don't like to work up fields. I'm not really a farmer. I'm more of a grass guy. I like everything to be grass. That's really what I like, grass and hay. Leave it sod for as long as you can. That's kind of, and that's the way it naturally is. It's really hard as a producer to let somebody tell you otherwise that lives in a concrete jungle. But
yes, And especially when the science is there stating otherwise. The EPA, you go to their website, it tells you livestock production responsible for only 2% of greenhouse gas emissions. And if anything, cattle are a sink. It's as a ruminant. They are upcyclers and they are a sink. So it's very difficult to how do you it doesn't matter, it seems, if you have the facts put right in front of somebody. They, especially nowadays, they will find another source stating otherwise. You know, you could have the 110% stated set facts. These are just facts. And they can find 10 sources that say otherwise. And that's just unfortunate. And it's...
Right. And they use statistics, and statistics, they try to, it's, you know, they try to say correlation is always causation. And I think anybody that understands that knows that it's not, you know, just because something correlates together sometimes and they can put numbers together to make things look a certain way doesn't mean that things are caused by that.
I have a statistic for you. Okay.
Okay.
We're talking about correlation and causation. Mm-hmm. Ice cream sales. How does this go? In the summertime, ice cream sales and murders correlate. They both go up in the summertime. Does that mean that there's a correlation? Not at all. But they do correlate. If you look at it, would you say
there's a correlation, but it's not causation?
Exactly.
Yeah. And people don't understand that. I mean, they try to find that statistics are great when used correctly, but they can lie to you as much as they can tell you anything. That's a lot of people don't, people do understand it, but unless you completely understand agriculture to know what would cause things and what wouldn't cause things, people believe any number you throw in front of them. And another big problem we have is people watch an hour long documentary on YouTube or something and then consider themselves an expert. You know, consider them to know more than me. That's done it my whole life. I've done every aspect of the cattle production. I've done a lot of row crop farming as much as I could think of. And they don't want to hear my opinion because they watch that hour long documentary. And
yes,
I guess you just can't argue with that then, because that, you know, you're wasting your time when somebody has their mindset.
But. Yes, because you don't have dramatic music playing while you right. talk about your livelihood.
Right. Yeah, so, I just try to lay out facts and then they think they have something over it, but it is what it is, you know. I think the more young people like me and you that can kind of spread a good message about agriculture and leave it in a good view from our friends and neighbors, that's as much as you can do. Try to spread it. We got social media now that we can spread the message, but you'll only get to the people that want to hear it. Some people don't want to hear it, so they'll never listen, which is unfortunate, you know. Most people could be a little more open-minded, probably myself included on some things. I don't know, but I wish everybody would look a little harder into it. You know, instead of blaming farmers for things, would ask questions. Well, why do you do it that way? Why do you do this? You know, and a lot of people don't. They like to just play the blame game right away.
Yeah. And I think most Americans are just curious, you know, but they get spoon-fed a lot of false information from mainstream media. It's very tough to escape it. And, you know, so they're just trying to do the right thing when they have meatless Mondays, or they, you know, are trying to eat less meat or eat organic or whatever you want to talk about. But, yeah, I think they're just trying to do the right thing, but they're just getting the wrong information. And that's unfortunate.
That is, because I agree that people are, they're trying to do what they think is best, what they've been told is best. And they don't know that that's wrong sometimes. So I can't blame them as the individual, because they're trying to do the best that they can, as most people in this country do, in my opinion. I think we've got a great population of people that just are a little bit misinformed when it comes to agriculture. I don't know. I hope we can change that a little bit, but most people are trying to do the best they can that I run into on a daily basis, and, you know, trying to make an impact. And that's hopefully we just get the right information out there and they'll listen to it.
Right. That's why people need to be listening to this podcast.
Yeah, there you go.
That's why we're here doing what we're doing. So let's talk about slaughter, humane slaughter. I've taken a few meats classes, and I've had to watch slaughter happen. And then we go through the whole process, and then, you know, we grade the meat and do all that jazz. But it's another topic that gets muddied by, I would say, animal rights groups and other people that are just misinformed.
Right.
Yeah. Where do you want to go with that? Where do you want to start with that?
As a cattle producer, you'd know, like I do, you see a lot of death at times. I think a lot of people live their whole life. They don't see many things die other than maybe what they hit on the road. The few extremely traumatic instances where it's a family member or friend that die, maybe a pet. When you live with livestock, you can see a lot of death at times. And being a producer, you realize there's ways that you can die that aren't the worst. And then there's absolutely horrible ways to die. You know, a lot of people don't realize that. I think that's a big fight against wolves up here, is they say, well, let animals die naturally. Well, a natural death by a wolf is for them to take you down and eat you from the butthole up and let you live until you bleed out, basically.
Exactly.
That would be a horrible way to die. Absolutely horrible. Where the slaughter plants, they come through, it's as quick and painless as they can make it. Absolutely. They try to make it as quick and painless. It's never easy to kill something, but when something like that has to be done, there it is. And you can't let them live forever because everything will die. That's one thing I learned. My first pony that I rode, I was 4 or 5 years old, had this little pony I rode around everywhere. My sister rode her around everywhere. Her name was Tonka. Great little horse. I was 12 one day. My dad was at a cow sale in Montana, and she couldn't get up anymore. And she was laying there. She'd been laying there for hours, banging her head against a rock, and I couldn't get her up. I tried all of that. I had to shoot my first pony when I was 12 years old. So I understand what natural death is all about, and it's not all that great. You know what I mean? I mean, yeah, it'd be great if everything could just have a heart attack in their sleep and be dead, but that isn't the way it usually works. They either get old and they starve to death slowly. You know, they can't get enough nutrition into their body. Natural death is nothing to want, you know? And people have a hard time accepting that. They think all death is kind of the same. We try to be as humane as we can when we slaughter animals. They're giving their life for us. You know, that's something I don't take lightly. Like I said, I've slaughtered a lot of animals in my life. I don't take it lightly that I'm taking their life from them, that I'm them going to use them, you know, to feed my family, to feed my friends. That's not something that any of us take lightly. And you just got to be as humane about it as you can.
Yeah. And I think it's important to bring up the point, or the fact, that at a slaughterhouse, is it a one-shot rule or two-shot rule? When they take the captive bolt that renders the animal senseless, if they miss, they're done. You're done. I think they shut down the plant. Things are fixed, you know, or things are adjusted. But you got one shot to render that animal senseless. Mm-hmm. And then they drain them of the blood, obviously. They hang them. Now, remember, you'll see videos as well. When they hang these fat cattle up, they'll be kicking and this and that. That's not because they are still alive. They are completely senseless. Like, they do not feel anything. That's just how it works.
It's just a nerve reaction. You know,
yeah.
I mean, it's just the way it is. Right. And that's one thing that I think our packing industry, especially in America, is so regulated, which in that aspect is a really good thing, to know that things are done humanely. You know, if you eat something slaughtered in the U.S., that it has been taken care of as humanely as possible. They did everything they could to, you know, not cause harm to it. That's one problem I had with the U.S. banning horse slaughter and then sending most of them to Mexico and Canada to be slaughtered, is then you cannot see how it's happening. I mean, the horses, when they're at the end of their life, it's like anything. Most of them, they're either going to end up buried in a hole somewhere in somebody's pasture, or they're going to sell them because they can't afford to feed them and they're going to go to slaughter. You know, when they go to Mexico to slaughter, do we know how they're treated? Do we know anything about it? Not really. So it was a hard part. It was very hard for me to understand why they made horse slaughter illegal in America, other than, you know, it's an emotional deal, which I understand. I love horses. You know that. Me and you grew up rodeoing together. We both love horses. That's a true passion of mine. But horse slaughter is an ugly fact of life that's going to have to happen.
Yeah. And so, you know, if we don't have horse slaughter, people get horses, like you said, that they can't afford. Well, then they think, well, I'll just go turn out old what's-his-face out in the Badlands of North Dakota, and he's just going to live this wonderful, lovely life. Well, that is not the case when you take a domesticated animal. You can't just go put them out in the wild. I mean, they don't have the instincts or the skills to live out their life like that. I mean, they're going to, it's not going to.
And even if they do, the way that they're probably going to die, that they're going to die is going to be absolutely horrible. You know, it's going to be like the pony that I had where she lays there trying to get up, smashing her head on a rock, bleeding all over, or a predator is going to kill them, you know, slowly. There's very few predators that kill things real fast. So if you think you're doing something a favor by doing that, it's short-sighted. You don't see where it's coming to. I think you can just put it behind you and never think about it again and just have a fairy tale in your head that it's going to have a heart attack and just die peacefully. But that's a fairy tale. 90% of the time, that is a fairy tale. They'll lose all their teeth and not be able to eat enough and just waste away. And that's the way it is. People don't realize that and they don't want to think about it because it's not a fun thing to think about, but it's reality. Reality is not always the funnest thing.
Exactly. And it is extremely short-sighted and I would even say selfish because as a human, you feel better maybe that these animals aren't being slaughtered in the U.S. anymore. But ultimately, the animals are still going to pay the price of, like you said, now slaughters happening in other countries that maybe are not as regulated as the U.S. Or these animals are, domesticated animals are put out in the wild to fend for themselves. They are the ones paying the price, not the people that want to end slaughter or end meat consumption. It is very short-sighted. They see the emotional aspect of it, and that's where it stops. They don't think about what comes after that and the repercussions of their ideas of how life should be or livestock production or just having pets in general. So it's very unfortunate. But
it is. But I think people like to avoid death in general. They like to act like it won't happen. I think part of the reason, I mean, I hate to bring it up, but the coronavirus deal, some people act like they would never die. Like that's the only thing could kill them. There's nothing else could kill them. To me, you know, I tried to stay precautious around my grandparents, everything that I felt like I had to do, especially early on. But my grandpa just told me, he said, well, something's going to kill me and I don't think it's going to be that. You know, he was ready. I mean, he had it and he lived right through it. And a lot of people, unfortunately, a lot of people didn't live through it, but a lot of people, I mean, you can die doing anything, especially that's another thing growing up with cattle. You have something try to kill you every once in a while. Most people have never had something actively want to kill them, you know, and that's a different kind of experience in life and it'll bring things into perspective for you. But
yeah. And it always seemed to be a Hereford or a Baldy. Either a Hereford cow or a Baldy cow. And I don't know
what this is. Right. The Herefords are either the absolute tamest, where you can't hardly make a move. You could pet them all day, probably hop on them and ride them if you want to. Or they could just go completely insane. You never know what they're going to do.
But. Yeah. You know, I'm not a breedist. I'm not against Herefords or black Baldy cows. I'm just saying, again, correlation does not equal causation or however you want to say
it. Yeah, I've got a lot of Baldy cows and I like them a lot, but yeah. I know what you're saying.
Yes. So let's talk about animal agriculture in regards to a sustainable future. Sustainability is the buzzword in agriculture right now. It's in every sentence, it seems like, when we're talking about ag. And I guess today we're probably going to talk more specifically about livestock production when it comes to sustainability. But cattle are definitely a part of that. Cattle are very important because it's, like I said, they are upcyclers of land. They take feedstuffs or feed that is inedible by humans and they turn that into protein. It's kind of like magic.
It really is. Yeah, I agree completely. And to be sustainable, I mean, ruminants are an amazing animal for what they can do. You know, you can use row crop. The big thing lately that I've seen a lot of people doing that I think is great is putting cover crops onto row crop fields and then grazing them through the winter as much as you can. You know, you're double using the land. It helps the land. The cattle are out there. They can eat. You don't have to produce as much feed for them for the winter, as much hay, things like that. And that's something you can only do with cattle. I mean, I don't know how you would necessarily, you know, run enough hogs and chickens to feed the country that way. You know what I mean? The cattle do it very well. They're very efficient at it. They can cover a lot of ground. They're easy to maintain. They're easy to fence in compared to, I would think a chicken would be fairly hard to keep rounded up all the time if you try to do it that way. But yeah,
free range. That's what I imagine when I see cage free eggs or whatever.
Somebody caught it with a net out in the middle of a grassland somewhere. Yeah, right. That's a fallacy a lot of people have. Exactly. But no, cattle are great that way. They can utilize so many things. I mean, living here, just the different things I fed. I feed a lot of, you know, I can grind up swamp grass and mix it with silage. You know, that's absolutely unusable by any other thing in the world. And I can mix it with silage, or I mix it with beet pulp, which is a sugar beet byproduct. You can mix it with that. I know guys that feed onion waste. A lot of people feed potato waste. You got all those things that cattle can just take in and turn into meat for us. Like you said, it's truly amazing. A lot of people don't understand it. They think that the cattle take food directly away from humans, and it couldn't be any more true at all. I mean, there's a little bit of grain used at the end. Most of them, any cow's life or steer's life is, you know, grass first and then grown. And then at the very end, they get some grain that pushes them to get fat. And, you know, there's guys that say they can finish them without grain even. I don't know. I've never ate enough of it to know if it's actually as good or not, but that's to be debated. But
right. Well, I think we finished a couple just straight hay. Turned out pretty good. I was shocked.
Yeah. There is grass fed.
They were half Aberdeen, half Angus.
Okay.
So, you know, a little smaller, a little more efficient, right. You know, sustainable, right. Sustainability.
There it is. Yep. But I don't know. Everybody's definition of sustainability is definitely different. You know, that's the hard part, because everybody says, how are you sustainable? Well, first give me your definition of sustainable, and then I can tell you what I'm doing to try to, you know, be included in that. But everybody's definition is different, so it's very hard to address that when everybody has a different idea in their head of what that is. But
yeah, and you know, cattle can take land that is not farmable. You cannot raise crops on it, and there's a lot of land like that, and they can take that land and turn it around again into protein. And not just protein, there are countless numbers of products that come from cattle. I mean, I should have a list, but it's endless. I mean, even insulin. I don't know that they get insulin from cattle anymore, but it definitely was, there was a time. And without cattle, a lot of that stuff, where are we going to get it? You know, people want to replace meat with plant-based proteins, but you still have to plant those. You still have to farm those. So again, cattle are taking land that cannot be farmed, and they're turning it into protein. They're preventing forest fires and they're cleaning that ground up. I mean, there's so many benefits to cattle production.
Right. And another thing is, people that eat a plant-based diet or anything like that, they try to act like they don't kill anything. Nothing dies. That couldn't be any farther from the truth either. I mean, any type of row crop production where you're tilling the soil, getting rid of the pests, there's a lot of things that die in there. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. That's just the way it is. But things naturally die. They're all going to die. And driving your car down the road, nobody thinks twice of it when they turn the windshield wipers on and push 100 bugs off that they just killed, but they'll eat a salad so they won't kill anything else. You know, they don't realize how many things had to die for that to happen. And again, I think that's a fairy tale people have in their head, is that they're trying to not kill as many things. And, you know, that's just part of the way the world is. That's the, you know, the food web, I guess you'd call it. It's just something dies and it just,
life.
It is, exactly. It's a cycle of life. And people don't understand that. And they try to pretend like it doesn't happen. That's easy to do in the cleanly environment that most Americans live in now. You know what I mean? Where they live in the city or in the suburbs, everything's manicured just perfect. Their lawns are nice. Everything's just right. They don't deal much with pests because there isn't many around anymore. They don't have coyotes out there trying to kill things in their backyard like we see as cattle producers. You know, and wolves and whatever else, we see all that, but most people don't ever witness that. So that's it's a fairy tale that most people try to live with. And they're just, most people, I think, eventually in life see something that changes their mind. But I think we got a lot of people our age that still need to see that.
Yeah. Well, again, it's less than 2%, but I always say there's 2% of us that are producing the other 98% food. And can you imagine if that 2% was just gone? People would have no clue where to begin.
Oh, man. Right. Yeah, the people in the cities, in any city, they know how dependent they are on everybody else. I think that's why there's such a divide in rural life versus city life, is the rural people act like, I don't need anybody else. I can do everything myself. I don't need you to survive. Where if you live in the middle of a big city and that's all you know, you have a deep down feeling that you need everybody else to survive. Somebody else is better put the food in the grocery store for you. Somebody else better keep the gas running to heat you. Somebody better do all of that stuff. And people won't admit it sometimes, I don't think, but deep down they know that it's true. They don't know how to do any of that. We're living out here, like where I'm at. I mean, I grew up with horses and cattle and we burn wood. And I guess if I had to go back to being Amish per se, almost could do it. You know, I think I could take care of myself, but it would be a challenge even for me living where I have resources to take advantage of. I couldn't imagine trying to think of a way to do it where I have no resources at my disposal. And I think that's why, yeah, like I said, people that live in cities they realize they're very dependent on everybody else. And that's why there's a divide in this country that, I don't know. That's what I think.
Yeah, and there's been books written about the communication gap between producers and consumers. So this is it's a real problem, and it's not going to get better unless we're doing things like this. But we also have to get people to listen and give them a reason. I think sometimes as farmers and ranchers, we almost... It goes both ways. You know, you got the city people that kind of poo-poo the rural people, and then you've got the rural people that kind of poo-poo the city people, when it's like, right. we all have something to offer. We all have something to teach the other person. So it's important to remember, you know, we can talk about how ignorant consumers are all day, but we also need to be understanding that their ignorance isn't exactly their fault. It's just that farmers and ranchers have become so efficient that people no longer have to worry about where their next meal is coming in a first world country like America. So
definitely. And people don't realize that is probably one of their biggest blessings, because I would say 90% of the people that have ever lived throughout history have had to worry about how they're going to get their food. You know, that, I mean, if you look back through the whatever millions of years that there's been people, it's only been in about the last 100 that you could count on food being readily available and not really giving it a second thought. And if people don't count that as a blessing and see that as something that is truly amazing and benefits them, I guess they're missing out. I think a lot of people do see it. They think there's better ways to do things, and there's always ways to get better. You know, I don't disregard when somebody tells me something, because there's always ways to get better at things. I'm always looking for ways to get better at everything I do. So, you know, I don't blame them for looking at how it's done, but they better first see that it is a blessing that they can live the way that they do.
Yeah, I would say one of the biggest privileges of being an American is our food choice. We really take that for granted, I would say. And cost. We Americans spend the least amount of money on our food than any other country. And it's actually... We only spend about 10% of our disposable income on our food. And and I think I read that, you know, 50% of that is spent on groceries and whatnot for your home, and then the other 50 is spent going out to eat.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's we don't spend a lot of money on food and we don't really have to worry about it, which is kind of amazing. If you would have told that to someone, you know, 200-300 years ago,
right,
blow their minds a little bit.
Right. And, you know, in today's world, we don't have to spend very much on food, which is great. But if people want to spend more to get something, you know, locally grown or organic, as long as they want to spend more for it, I have no problem with it. Because then, I mean, it's going to, you know, you vote on everything you do with your dollars. And if they want organic and they're willing to spend more to get it, well, because it's not as efficient. So you're going to have to spend more to get it. You know, that's one thing they don't understand. But you can't tell everybody to go organic just because you prefer organic. You know, you right. can't take away everybody else's freedom of choice because you prefer one product. And I think that's, you know, one issue we have is a lot of people try to push their ideology on to other people. And if we can avoid that, and just like I said, if I prefer organic, I'd buy organic. I really don't. You know, I know how everything's raised on my farm, and that's, I've got no problem with it. So I eat whatever. I've got no problem going to any grocery store in the country and feeling safe with what I'm buying.
Right. And that's, you know, another thing. We raise some of the safest, most humane products there are in the world. And we're just trying to keep up. 2050, it's coming up in about 30 years. I don't know if we'll see it, maybe. But
hope so, I guess. We'll see.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah, so is there anything else you want to touch on today that we maybe didn't talk about that you'd like to, or, you know, any words you'd like to leave us with today?
Oh, not really, I guess. I'm just happy that there's people like you out there that are going to spread the word, especially to younger generations, about agriculture. Try to be a face that people can see, you know, and ask questions to. I try to do that as much as I can. I'm not on social media a whole lot. You know, that's not really my forte. Technology in general is not my forte, but I still try to bring it in a good light. You know what I mean? Have everybody respect what I do and see that I try my best at it, no matter what I'm doing.
Yeah. You know, I don't think anybody gets into agriculture to be a keyboard warrior by any means,
right,
or to defend their way of life or the way they make a living. But that's kind of where we're at now. And, you know, this is said a lot. If we don't start stepping up as producers and voicing our opinions and our thoughts, we are going to find ourselves in a place where we're going to be told what to do. So yeah, right. we really do need to step up. It needs to be taken seriously. I mean, sometimes I feel a little bit useless that I'm not out doing the thing, you know, moving cattle or physically being out there and doing it. But this is my way of contributing, I guess.
And sure, so, and I feel the same way sometimes being an auctioneer. You know, I would love to just run more cattle and be at home every day and take care of cattle, but I'm hardly ever home anymore. And I just got to do my part in agriculture, which I think is to be an auctioneer and to try to market things as best as I can. And that's no different than you. I mean, we both have a passion for the industry and we're going to help it wherever we see how. And I think as long as everybody does that, we'll be all right.
Absolutely. Well, Luke, I just want to thank you for taking the time to come on here today. Hopefully it's not another 10 years that go by before I see your face.
Right. Yeah, I hope to see you around a little more often. For sure.
And we don't have to steal beer anymore because, well, we're 29 and 30. We're real adults.
Right. It's been a long time since I had to sneak that around. But
no, it was more fun when it was illegal, I guess.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. Now I'm just busy, and if I can have one here and there, that's about all it seems like.
Yeah, that's about all I need. But thank you again for coming on here today and talking about these issues. They're so important. I just want to touch on next week, episode 9 will be with Brittany Olson. We will be talking about food safety, and I know she has a lot of opinions. I went to school with her at NDSU. She's a smart gal. So I'm looking forward to that. Again, thank you, Luke. This is Agriculture Podcast, episode 8. I'm Jessica Benson with the American Ag Network out of Fargo, North Dakota.